Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Yousef Mounir, Executive Director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, who assesses the results of the April 9th Israeli election, where voters embraced Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and permanent occupation of the Palestinian people. Joe Emmersberger, a Canadian-based independent journalist, who explains why he believes that U.S. charges being brought against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange pose a serious threat to press freedom. Ann Nelson, a Salvadoran man seeking asylum in the U.S., who talks about the reasons he fled his home country with his wife and daughter after receiving death threats from drug cartels in El Salvador. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A surprise assault on Tripoli, Libya, by a militia commanded by a former loyalist to Muammar Gaddafi, scuttled a United Nations peace initiative in the war-weary North African nation. At the time of the attack, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres was in Libya mediating talks with the hope that it would lead to a peace summit meeting. Militia leader Khalifa Haftar, commander of the so-called Libyan National Army based in Benghazi, is supported by France, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. On the other side, the UN, European Union, and the United States back the interim government of National Accord in Tripoli. Now militias on both sides are fighting in the outskirts of Tripoli and at the international airport, raising fears that this battle could trigger a full-scale civil war. Haftar, who lived in exile in the U.S. for 20 years under CIA protection, has long dismissed diplomacy and called for military force to impose unity in oil-rich Libya. While the UN and Western powers have called for a ceasefire in Tripoli, the internationally recognized government says it will agree to a ceasefire only if Haftar's troops withdraw from the capital and return back east. Villages and towns in the highlands of Guatemala have emptied out as farmers hurt by climate change and dire poverty have migrated to the United States. These villages, largely populated by indigenous people, depended on only a few basic crops, including maize, to feed their families. But according to the New Yorker magazine, with rising temperatures and extreme weather linked to climate change, Guatemalans from the highlands are fleeing in increasing numbers. The malnutrition rate, which hovers around 65% in the highlands, is among the highest in the Western Hemisphere. In 2014, a group of agronomists and scientists working on an initiative called Climate, Nature, and Communities of Guatemala produced a report that cautioned lawmakers about the region's susceptibility to a new threat. The highlands, they wrote, was the most vulnerable area in the country to climate change. The Obama administration pledged roughly $750 million to an aid package for Central American nations known as the Alliance for Prosperity, which aimed to address mounting poverty, political corruption, and cycles of crime and violence. However, very little of that money dealt with issues of environmental sustainability. In July 2017, the Trump administration ended funding for the Climate, Nature, and Communities program, and on April 12th, Trump announced that he was cutting all aid to El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala because the three countries, quote, haven't done a thing for us. Monsanto, maker of the herbicide Roundup, is being held accountable for its corporate misconduct as two juries in California ruled the active chemical in Roundup causes cancer. A federal jury in California unanimously decided that the weed killer Roundup was a substantial factor in causing the lymphoma of 70-year-old Edwin Hardman, who had used Roundup on his property for many years, awarding him $80 million in damages. Earlier in August 2018, another jury concluded that groundskeeper Dwayne Lee Johnson developed cancer due to his exposure to Roundup and ordered Monsanto to pay Johnson nearly $300 million in damages. Monsanto, now owned by Bayer, faces over 11,000 lawsuits claiming the agent in Roundup, called glyphosate, caused cancer in people who use their product. Bayer continues to maintain that Roundup, with annual sales over $9 billion, is safe. In response to the lawsuits, however, retail outlets are reconsidering sale of the herbicide. Warehouse membership store Costco recently pulled Roundup from its shelves. Monsanto's internal communications, unsealed in Hardman's trial, showed that the company had an aggressive PR strategy that involved attacking negative research and ghostwriting and pushing favorable studies. Internal documents also shined a harsh light on Monsanto's cozy relationship with U.S. regulators, prompting the jury in Dwayne Johnson's case to declare that the corporation had acted with malice and was responsible for his cancer. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After winning a close race against his nearest opponent, former Israel Defense Force Chief Benny Gantz of the centrist Blue and White Party, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is heading towards a record fifth term in office. After the April 9th election, Netanyahu and his supporters were confident that they'll be able to put together a coalition of their Likud party with other right-wing and ultra-Orthodox Jewish parties in the Israeli Knesset or parliament. This despite the fact that the Israeli Prime Minister faces likely indictments in three corruption and bribery cases brought against him. During the campaign, Netanyahu pledged to annex Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank if re-elected, a move in direct defiance of international law and United Nations resolutions. Hanan Ashrawi, a prominent member of the Executive Committee of the Palestine Liberation Organization, declared that the election results confirm the persistence of what she called Israel's racism and extremism. Your reporter spoke with Youssef Moner, executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Here he discusses the outcome of Israel's election, Netanyahu's campaign pledge to annex Jewish settlements in the West Bank, and the role the Trump administration played in emboldening Netanyahu's commitment to a permanent Israeli occupation of the Palestinian people.
The main opposition parties to Netanyahu, and you're right, he is likely to form a right-wing religious coalition, very similar to the previous coalition. The opposition was not really opposing Netanyahu's policies towards the Palestinians. In fact, they didn't campaign in any way on opposing his policies towards the Palestinians. If anything, they came out with a very similar line on these issues. The head of the opposition party, who was himself a former Israeli military chief of staff, launched his campaign by bragging about how many Palestinians he had killed. And his position towards the question of peace was, in his own words, they will continue to build and strengthen the settlement blocks. They will never divide Jerusalem. They will forever hold on to the Golan Heights, and they will hold on to the Jordan Valley. Of course, this is the vast majority of the West Bank. And they would retain security control throughout the entirety of the territory. This is just a fancy way of saying that they will never end the occupation. This is the opposition to Netanyahu, not Netanyahu himself, right? So they are really speaking one language when it comes to this issue. And so as far as the Palestinian people are concerned, as far as Palestinian rights are concerned, this election was really a competition between one Trump-like figure and another when it comes to the rights of Palestinians.
During the campaign, Netanyahu pledged to annex Jewish settlements in the Palestinian West Bank if reelected, extending full Israeli sovereignty over settlements widely considered illegal under international law. I wondered if you would dig down a little bit into what we may see now from Netanyahu, now that he's likely to form the next coalition government.
Right. In some ways, this is not particularly new, but in some ways it is. It's not really new in that the position of Netanyahu, the position of his party, for a very long time has consistently been the complete rejection of Palestinian sovereignty in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. They've always opposed that. They continue to oppose it. They continue to support the building of settlements, the colonization of Palestinian territory. and so on. And, you know, he said something very similar on the eve of the last election when he declared definitively, there will never be a Palestinian state on my watch. And so, you know, this idea of retaining control forever in Palestinian territory is not really new. What is different now, though, is the language that they're using to describe this control. And they're talking about annexation. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, the territory in the West Bank has in many ways already been annexed by Israel, particularly Area C. What has not happened is that the Israelis have not afforded the Palestinians there the rights that they would afford to Israeli citizens in other Israeli territory, particularly the right to vote in elections. Millions of Palestinians were denied a right to vote in this election because they are not Israeli citizens, despite the fact that they're living under the control of the Israeli military. But, you know, now we're starting to hear this talk about annexation, and obviously, you know, Netanyahu feels emboldened by this election victory. He's going to be relying very much on right-wing religious nationalists for whom, you know, the West Bank is ideologically important territory, who, of course, want to retain control over it forever. And also, very importantly, he has been emboldened by an administration in the White House, which has really given him almost every item on his wish list, from recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, something the Trump administration did that no previous administration was willing to do, to recognizing Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights, which was very recent, of course, during the lead up to this election, and also something that no previous administration was willing to do. So, you know, Netanyahu knows now that he has a friend in the White House in President Trump, and he may be able to get the Trump administration to recognize once again a step that he would take in annexing territory in the West Bank, part of it or all of it, in the hopes of creating an irreversible reality that future administrations would be reluctant or would not be able to reverse. He sees a window of opportunity to reach for, you know, his greatest colonialist dreams, and he may very well seek to take that opportunity in the weeks and months to come.
That was Youssef Mounir, executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Find more analysis and commentary on the Israeli election and Netanyahu's victory by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange was arrested inside Ecuador's London embassy on April 11th after that nation's president, Lenin Moreno, withdrew asylum protection. Assange took refuge in the diplomatic compound in 2012 to avoid extradition to Sweden over a sexual assault case that has since been dropped. Assange now faces extradition to the U.S., where the Justice Department recently unsealed an indictment of Assange, filed in March 2018. If Britain extradites Assange to the U.S., he'll face one count of conspiracy to commit computer intrusion related to incriminating Pentagon documents on Washington's human rights abuses in the Iraq War, published by WikiLeaks, which were received from then-U.S. Army Private Chelsea Manning in 2010. Assange's lawyer, Jennifer Robinson, said they would be fighting extradition to the U.S. and warned that it would set a dangerous precedent where any journalist could face U.S. charges for publishing truthful information about the United States. Your reporter spoke with Joe Emmersberger, an independent Canadian-based journalist, who talks about the arrest of Julian Assange and the serious threat to press freedom.
Chelsea Manning, who's in jail again because she's refusing to testify to a grand jury, she's already spent 7 years in jail because she was the Defense Department analyst who leaked files to WikiLeaks. And she spent 7 years in jail. I mean, it's just to think about that. She exposed war crimes. That's why she did this. She was horrified by what was going on in Iraq. There was that infamous collateral murder video that that WikiLeaks released that came from Manning, where it showed the U.S. troops in Iraq gunning down civilians and laughing about it. One of the troops involved got kicked out of the army because he subsequently requested medical psychiatric attention for the trauma of treating children who were seriously wounded in that attack. So it was just a horrific thing that they exposed. And so that alone, just based on that alone, Manning herself should never spend a day in jail. And she spent 7 years. I mean, she exposed horrific crimes. So whatever breach of contract or confidentiality she perpetrated, it's totally justified by what she was trying to expose. And that extends. So if she shouldn't spend any time in jail, obviously Assange, who merely was acting as a publisher, trying to get the information out. If you read the indictment, it basically, most of it is just accusing him of doing journalism, of working with a source. But there's one specific thing the media has latched onto where it says that Assange in the indictment, item 7 of the indictment, says there was an agreement, alleged agreement between him and Manning to try to crack a password so that Manning could download the files in a way that would help her avoid detection. So he was trying to help her download the files in a way where she wouldn't get caught and, you know, suffer horrific, suffer terrible consequences. And you could tell from the indictment from item 10 that, because they say they used the word would have, you know, that it would have allowed Manning to log on and would have made it more difficult for investigators to find out who she was. So basically, they're in the indictment itself, the so-called agreement, whatever it was, if it existed between Assange and Manning, it didn't work. So it's not even what resulted in the files being downloaded. So, I mean, it's just flimsy all over the place. The law should protect somebody who did what Manning did. The same way, you know, the law should protect, you know, if I use violence for no reason, obviously I should be held accountable. But if I use violence to protect myself or to protect somebody else, then the law should protect me. The law should not throw the book at me. And that's basically the approach people should take to Manning and to Assange, obviously.
Joe, what are the essential issues that the British judiciary will have to deal with in the coming extradition hearing as to whether or not Assange will be extradited to the United States to face these charges?
When you mentioned the extradition hearing, it's very worrying because the UK government is not going to face a lot of pressure from a lot of people who should be sticking up for Assange, will be making a very half-hearted defense. It shows that Theresa May's government, the UK, will not face a lot of pressure if she decides to just ship him off to the United States. Now, the leader of the opposition in the UK, Jeremy Corbyn, he came out with a very strong statement initially, anyway, defending Assange very forcefully, pointing to the collateral murder video in his tweet he sent out and saying that he should not be punished for releasing this information. So that was very encouraging. But within his own party, there's such reactionary people who would just be happy to see Assange shipped away or put up a very hypocritical, a half-hearted defense, which, again, just makes it easy for him to be shipped to the United States.
Joe, I wonder if you would explain to our audience how these charges pending in the United States against Assange could jeopardize freedom of the press if Assange is extradited to the U.S. and is found guilty and imprisoned. How does this affect the work of investigative journalists here in this country?
In a recent article I wrote for FAIR, I noted that even the former general counsel of the New York Times, he said that this whole idea of a conspiracy charge is probably one of the most dangerous things, threats to the free press that the Trump administration could possibly do. Because if it's such a vague thing, if a journalist is contacting a source confidentially, if the journalist is trying to encourage him to say, hey, what can you get for me? If the journalist is dealing with somebody who they know is not supposed to be doing this, right, is not supposed to be getting the information, even if the journalist isn't actually doing it, right, actually breaking into the computer itself, but just trying to help or work with the source or, suggest, give advice about how to avoid detection or anything like that, it'll be the burden of proof will be on the journalist to prove that they haven't done something wrong. This will impact the journalists who actually want to do something. It won't impact the journalists who just want to curry favor with the powerful, which is unfortunately most corporate journalists, in my opinion. But it will affect those who actually try to expose wrongdoing and publish things that the powerful people really do not want published. Because that's when the journalism really becomes important and valuable, is when you're actually publishing something, most valuable anyway, when you're actually publishing something that they want hidden. That's what Assange did to a huge extent, and that's why they're going after him.
That was Joe Emmersberger, an independent Canadian-based journalist. Find links to his recent articles on the arrest of Julian Assange and threats to press freedom by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Thousands of people from El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and southern Mexico keep heading to the southern U.S. border with their children, hoping to gain asylum in the U.S. Most are fleeing from violence, poverty, and climate change exacerbated drought. There are many specific requirements that must be met to qualify for asylum in the U.S. These standards had included fleeing from gang violence or domestic violence, but the Trump administration has been steadily restricting the reasons a person can claim asylum and says it will no longer accept such claims in granting asylum status. An immigration attorney explained that while 90% or more of migrants pass their credible fear hearing at the border, very few actually win asylum and will be deported back to their home countries. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus recently spent 9 days on both sides of the border in Tucson, Arizona, in Nogales, Sonora, Mexico, interviewing both migrants hoping to get into the U.S. and those who had passed a credible fear hearing and were on their way to reside with sponsors. In a tiny room in Mexico, very near the Nogales border crossing, Tuhus interviewed a Salvadoran man named Nelson. Because he'd previously worked in the U.S. and Canada, he spoke English, but said he returned to his country in 2011, hoping things would be better. But he found little had changed in El Salvador, so he fled with his wife and daughter. Here he talks about the threats he and his family received from drug cartels in Salvador that drove him to seek asylum in the U.S.
As soon as we heard that if you came to here to the border and asked for a refugee status too, you can get help. So that's how we do it. We came here and asked for help. I mean, we got proof of what is happening right now with my family, right? So I know there is so many people that came and it's just a lie, or I don't know. We start like a process here. Every people who came here receive a number, all right? Yeah. So, for example, I'm number 1,147.
When did you get here to this room?
Yesterday and in the afternoon.
And do you think you'll be leaving in another day or something? Or?
Maybe in another day, probably by tomorrow.
And then you're going to go to the border. You're going to get in the immigration process in the U.S. You have to convince U.S. officials that you have a credible fear.
Yes,
like they say, credible fear.
That's the first thing, the credible fear.
Do you have any documentation, or you're just going to tell your story like you just told us and hope they believe you?
Yes, that's what I hear. And the first time you have to speak with the truth, right, and say everything what is happening. But then after, when you have the court, then you can prove, show all the proof that you have. Even if they ask for something, yes, I do. I have some papers with me that can show that why I'm running out from my country, right?
Do the cartels, when they do the extortion, do they ever give you any, do they give you written warnings or threats, or they just come and talk to you?
No, warnings, threats, yes,
so
I do.
You don't have anything showing that if you don't pay
yes,
that
I
X
do.
Amount.
Yes,
oh,
I do.
Do.
Yes, like the text message from WhatsApp and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah, and also they came to my my business. They closed my business. I got proof of where I was located and also invoices and stuff like that. so many things that can prove that. That's another thing that we don't like to be here. We don't want to work over here because there is like a two cartels over here that they control everything. For example, if I go out after 6 p.m., 7 p.m., I'm on risk that they can take me and start asking for money over there on USA if I have a family over there.
Now, will you describe this room for me and tell me who's here?
Okay, it is a small room. We are like a 17 people here. And the room is about like probably, I don't know, 5 or 6, something like that, with a small bathroom. We all use the bathroom. We don't have a toilet paper. Each of us have to see how can deal with that, right? Yeah. And as a mattress, we have like, I don't know, how do you call this? It's not like And we sleep all,
And there's so many kids, little kids. How they seem like they're doing okay, but...
Most of them, they are 6 right now. They have a chicken pops and stuff. Right. Mine doesn't have it, right? But I'm scared that the chicken grab it. I don't want that.
Tell me just what your hopes are for getting out of here and going to the United States.
My hopes?
Yeah.
Well, my hopes is to first of all to be safe. That's the main thing that I want right now. See, my children is just like 3 years and a half. And I want the best future for her. I do, as I know USA and I know Canada, I know how can I get a work and do something good for my family, right? And good for the country too. I don't want to be any pain of nobody.
That was Nelson, a Salvadoran migrant waiting for his chance to apply for asylum in the U.S., For more information on the groups helping migrants on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBDY in Binghamton, New York, WXOJ in Florence, Massachusetts, KYRS in Spokane, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.